Good morning, and welcome to the June 26, 2017 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District. I'd like to remind everyone in the audience to please silence your cell phones and any other electronic devices that you may have with you today. Today's meeting is a study session and a business session, with the study session starting this morning at 10 a.m. and the afternoon business session starting at 1 o'clock. We welcome the public's input at our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you come to the microphone to speak. Please state your name and address for the record. Today, we have a quorum with four commissioners being present. Commissioner Smith has been excused. All of the customary staff and members are here today, including the General Manager, Steve Wright, General Counsel, Eric Walquist, and Clerk of the standing in as clerk of the board, Teresa. So we will start our meeting today.
And if I could add, Lisa Sanders is here to, she will be managing as clerk of the board for this meeting and the next meeting. And Teresa Boucher will be taking over after that.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Yep.
We'll start our meeting today with the Pledge of Allegiance and a safety minute led by Janet Dorich.
I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, all. I'm Janelle Ulrich.
I'm sorry.
The Generation Asset Program Manager of the district. And I have a safety minute for today, given that next week's going to be July already. Thought we would quickly go over firework safety. Reminder that at this time, fireworks are not legal in the city of Wenatchee. The big proposal is that everyone goes down to Walla Walla Park and safely enjoys the fireworks there. And please, as a reminder, don't take your pets down there. If you are out in an area that's safe and legal to have fireworks, a few precautionary notes there. They highly recommend that you do not have teenagers involved too heavily in fireworks unless they're very carefully instructed on what to do, as a lot of the injuries that happen with fireworks happen with teens, and that whomever is using the fireworks use eye protection at all times. A note was made to take a lot of care with duds because they often appear to be duds but aren't always, so it's recommended that you put them in a bucket of water and keep an active hose nearby. Used fireworks should also go in the same bucket of water and be soaked overnight in a place away from fire danger. And finally, to make sure that all people understand that alcohol and fireworks don't mix or any other legal substances. So that's what I had for a safety report.
Well, and that's very timely given the wildfires now that are raging across the West. I heard in Utah the fires now up to 47,000 acres. So, yeah, fireworks are doesn't mix well with dry timber.
No.
Thank you, Janelle. Well, commissioners, we have been presented an agenda. Items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Do I hear any such requests or additions to the agenda? Anyone else? Okay. Items 10 and 12, we move to the consent. All right. Hi, Sheila. I see you in the audience. Hi there. Well, I thank you for being here. I wanted to just take a second. That Sheila is here to recognize Sheila Salmon. Sheila, of course, has been the clerk of the board for over 10 years now, and we really have appreciated the fact that you've helped us out, especially a young guy like me, a new commissioner that didn't understand the acronyms, didn't understand the agendas. You really were a big help. So we wanted to just, as a collective board, take a moment and recognize that you have helped us over the many years with the flower.
You shouldn't have. I'm glad you did. Thank you.
Well, and in addition, we have a gift certificate for you to Go USA for the purpose of purchasing some logo clothing.
Wow, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Oh, my goodness, they keep coming.
And I want to present this to you.
Okay.
At the same time. And I love you. You've been great.
Oh, thank you so much.
I know where you are.
Yes, I'm just around the corner.
So I'll find you.
Thank you. These girls will do a wonderful job for you. If you need anything, though, you know you can call me.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheila. Thank you.
As the new guy in the block, I really appreciated just the countless effort that you made to help me get on board. So thank you very much. I appreciated that very much.
And you know you won't be rid of me. I'll still be bugging you and asking for help, and you won't get rid of me, Sheila.
Thanks a lot. You got to
thank you, Sheila. All right. Well, Steve, at this point, we'll turn the meeting over to you for introduction of the agenda items.
Okay. So first up, we want to talk about what will be a request for proposals for the Rock Island Storage Building. I believe Brett's going to come up and help us with that. This is the first project that we have brought under the Strategic Facilities Plan. So we're still learning our way on this, and I may make a couple of comments at the end, too, about how we're thinking about doing this. But let's go ahead and hear from Brett.
Good morning. I'm Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management, and with me is Devin Myers. He's a moved from our planner group in generation over to EPM. You guys approved the additional resources that we needed to implement a number of these projects that we're endeavoring, and so Devin is now in our project management group, and he's managing the storage building at Rock Island.
Good morning. I am Devin Myers, as Brett mentioned there. Yeah. So this morning I'd like to talk to you about the storage building down at Rock Island that we're proposing to build. What I'd like to do today is to just give you an update on the status of that project, and then also ask for approval to go out to bid for the construction of that building. We have a resolution that we'll be presenting this afternoon. Okay. So covered storage at Rock Island is very limited, and at both powerhouses, the floors can be very crowded, especially during overhaul times, and using them as storage facilities just intensifies that. You can see here's a few examples. We have on the upper left is the generator floor at Powerhouse 1, and those crates you see there are full of rotor irons, things that they would stack around the rotor before they put the rotor in the unit, and they're storing crates like that between the units on the generator floor. The upper right picture is components that would be used in the B7 modernization in the future. And that is a governor tank and a turbine shaft that's being stored between units on the floor in Powerhouse 2. So a lot of our current storage that we have down at Rock Island are repurposed buildings that we contractors built back in the day, like the Quonset huts that we have there were built during the 70s during Powerhouse 2 construction. And we've just repurposed them, turned them into storage buildings. The storage building that we're proposing will be used for the next, 15-plus years during modernization and then off into the future as a part of the strategic facilities plan. They saw a need for inventoried storage and warehousing spaces up there that are usable. Again, we have some pictures here. That upper left corner, I took a glance at it this morning. I thought I accidentally put a picture of my kids' bedroom in there, but it's actually the generator floor at Powerhouse 1. You can just see how crowded it is. And also, the top right picture is one of the exciters that will be used during the B1 through B4 modernization. It's covered with a tarp because we're trying to protect it from smoke and dust during the B6 modernization that's going on right now in Powerhouse 1. We also store things outside, as you can see here. The bottom left photo is a picture of generator stator sections that are going to be used in B7. You know, they're in the shipping crates with tarps over top of them, which is definitely not the ideal way to store that type of equipment. And then on the bottom left, we have the head cover for B6 that is being stored over there underneath the Powerhouse 2 gantry crane. Although those don't need to be stored inside, just having locations to put things that are not underneath or in a traffic pattern or underneath the crane that we use to unload a lot of equipment as it shows up for the modernizations as they take place. This storage building, as I was saying earlier, has been identified as a critical part of the facilities plan moving forward. Beyond modernization, it will be used as a place that they can keep locked up inventory, controlled storage, and spare parts for all the units as we build them out. This is kind of a tie-in to the new strategic facilities plan. Previously, the way that we did things, as quick and cheap as we could get it done, and yet, as you can see, there was a lot of repurposed buildings that we've used as storage buildings or workshops or things like that down there. The new philosophy with the strategic plan is to a more of a proactive, long-range look, and it maximizing productivity by getting tools and materials closer to the work. This is also trying to eliminate cross-deck traffic. Down there on any given day during the work week, you can have over 100-plus trips across the deck, and you've been down there and seen it's a one-lane road that you can't see the other end of. So oftentimes you end up with people either backing off the spillway or backing into a gate slot trying to get out of the way to let people pass. So it just delays things. And one of the other things about a purpose-designed building like this for a storage building is safety. You saw that picture earlier of the way we store things inside the Quonset huts. Well, those Quonset huts are long and narrow, and as you store things and need to get things out, oftentimes you're moving equipment several times to get the piece that you need. Moving equipment like that more than, you know, 1 to 10 times, you increase the chances of damaging that equipment or just the employee risks, too, of having to rig things and move things around in tight quarters. So that's how by designing a building that's kind of designed for storage, we're thinking we can get things and set them in there in places to where they'll be accessible as they're needed, not having to move a bunch of things out of the way. So our objectives for this project are to build a climate-controlled storage building that will keep critical components out of the weather, the dust, and risk of physical damage by just sitting in the yard or off of a roadway somewhere. Improve a water supply system to meet fire codes. I'll get into that in just a little bit. And also just to be consistent with our strategic facilities plan as it's moving forward. As Brett mentioned, this is kind of the first step into that plan. Our schedules. Right now we basically have the design for the storage building. We used local engineers and architects to get our design built, but currently we have a district staff reviewing the plans and the drawings and the specs. Our plan is to go out to bid late July, early August, and to award in September. We would like to be able to break ground on this project late fall, early winter, completing the project early spring next year in conjunction with the B1 through B4 modernization. As I talked about earlier, fire protection. This building will need fire protection in it to meet codes and to do what we need to do to build the building. We're fortunate that over on the Chelan County side, we have the water storage that we need to meet that requirement, but we do not have the fire flow that we would need to meet that requirement. And so kind of a side project as part of this project is to build a water conveyance system, which would consist of piping and booster pumps to get the water in the amount, the flow rates that you need to meet the code to for fire protection. Yeah. So our design criteria is basically done. We know what we want to do, although we're kind of revisiting it a little bit with taking into account all of the facilities plan up there. We've have selected a consultant. It's RH2 because of their ties with the existing facilities plan already and their knowledge of what's going on. But when we started talking with them, they said, well, maybe we should, along with making this the fire conveyance system, it would also supply potable water to the other buildings up there. And so they're kind of re-looking at that just a little bit as we go forward. This is a separate project, but it will be done in conjunction with the, they'll be done at the same time as the storage building is built. So it should not delay the project. Anything you wanted to add there? Okay. So requested actions. We'll be back this afternoon to request approval to go out for bid for the Rock Island Storage Building, bid number 1753. Next steps.
So this project was originally conceived about a year and a half ago. It was conceived to be a pretty simple structure, just enough square footage and headroom for the equipment for B1 to B4. As part of the facilities plan, we are looking at this long term. It's not just a short-term storage building for a particular project. We see a lot of value in utilizing this building for also Powerhouse 2 rehab and then converting this and repurposing it for long-term maintenance and storage needs. And so this building grew from about 10,000 square foot simple metal building to about a 20,000 square foot building now with a very high 40-foot ceiling. We're looking at materials of construction that will last 50 to 100 years. And so the project budget has grown. This is what our current estimate is now, is about $6.3 million. What we're going to do during this bid phase is look at life cycle costs with different bidders, look at metal, concrete composite, and concrete. And through that, hopefully this cost can come down. This is our engineer's estimate at this point. As I spoke with some of you this fall and this spring about looking at life cycle costs, we talked about the buildings that we have in our parks and whether you can build a stick frame building or whether you build a concrete masonry building or whether you put tile on the floor or the walls or don't. And so we'll be looking at those different features in these buildings. And it will kind of help us refine that district standard for our storage facilities at the hydros. So as we go forward again, we'll be working on that through the bidding phase. And then when we come back for an award, we'll be able to share with you those options that we looked at and come up with a final budget number for that based on life cycle cost.
This is a good chance for me to. I want to add a couple of comments because this is an important transition that we're making here. This is we have not had a strategic facilities plan before, and so now we're making a transition from a facilities plan to individual decisions about buildings. We're trying to make sure that we get the procedures and protocols right as we think this through. One of the things that we've done is looked at, first of all, what was the cost that was assumed in the strategic facilities plan versus the costs that are estimated here. And Brett, I'm going to ask you to confirm this. My understanding is the 6.3 million, the number is lower than what was assumed in the strategic facilities plan.
That's correct.
And so we, continue to strive for cost-effective approaches that create value for customers. And in the big picture, we're confident that something at this cost would create long-term life cycle best value for ratepayers. Now, having said that, we don't want to make that the only curb that we use to define where we will go with individual facilities. We want to make sure that we are testing each facility to figure out whether the big picture set of assumptions actually fit in reality. And that's why Brett and his group will look at options like concrete versus steel or hybrids of those two as a mechanism to test whether, in fact, for this building, what creates best value for ratepayers for the long term. So the strategic plan gives us that broad guidance, but we still have to translate that to individual decisions, and we want to make sure as we're going through and making those individual decisions that we're testing for that cost effectiveness that we know is critical to the whole reason for pursuing a facilities plan in the first place.
I can certainly say from recently taking a tour out at Rock Island, the facility is sorely needed. that many of the buildings that are in existence today were built by contractors many years ago, built with the intent of existing only during a project that they were working on. So we have squeezed additional years of life out of these buildings. Many are not built in a way to accommodate what it is we need. So certainly this is something that probably long overdue is an understatement.
What happens with the old buildings?
We'll continue to use them as needed. We've talked about maybe repurposing them for vehicle storage and things like that.
Yeah.
But then we look at, again, the maintenance that needs to go into them, and then at that some point in time, when that maintenance gets to be too expensive, then we just remove them.
Yeah, that's what I was curious about, because at some point it's going to cross the line in terms of value. Oh, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. Can you go back one slide? I just wanted to make sure it was, these guys did a great job mentioning this. It just, we spent some time talking about what we would do with the current budget, and I wanted to make sure it was clear. There's currently $1.1 million in the budget, so we're going to go out to bid. We're going to get a number back that's north of that, and so we wrestled with when do we bring a budget revision back to the board. We thought the best time would be once they get their estimates, they look at the whole life, cost analysis associated with the options. We'd have a real number we'd come back to the board with at that point in September timing to say this is what we would need to build this building in addition to what we already have in the budget. So just wanted to make sure that was clear.
Thank you, Kirk.
Okay, next up, we have been going through a series of discussions about rates, and this will be another part of that conversation. I want to invite Kelly Boyd, Mark O'Brien up to talk about business line financial policies, particularly as it applies to the integrated electric business.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning, commissioners. For the record, for the formal introductions, I am Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial and Risk Officer, and joining me is...
Mark O'Brien, Director of Strategic Financial Planning.
And as Steve mentioned, we are here again as a continuation of our almost year-long effort to update and extend our financial policies and guidance. We've already completed the updates of our district-wide policies in the first half of our business line policies, which included water, wastewater, and fiber. And today we'll begin our focus on the integrated electric business line. So we're still in this phase two of the project, but we're in the second part of the phase. And again, you may be wondering, why are we doing this now when our financial results are so strong and stable? And that's exactly why we're doing it now, because immediate action is not needed. So this helps us get ahead of some of the new things that we see coming at us in the future, things like distributed generation, electric vehicles, more high-density load, all of those things we see in the future. So getting well-positioned now will help us be where we want to be ahead of the time, rather than have to react during the time. And then I also wanted to emphasize as part of this process that it is an iterative process. We added kind of the red arrows to make sure it was clear to see that as we go through this, we're providing building blocks. And each layer that we do is kind of a foundation for the next layer. But as we get all the way through the process, we may realize that something we put in place earlier or thought about earlier, maybe it needs to be shored up once we get down to the end of the process and we know more and realize that we need to go back and go through another iteration. So I did want to emphasize that, because that is why this is such a long process, is because we build, but then we realize that we need to maybe refine something that we did earlier in the process. So that we expect that to be the same this time. So for our what we'll cover today is we will review the current financial forecast and planning around integrated electric, discuss the related long-term revenue planning for that, and talk about what's next up in the series. And all of these items are information only. No action is required today. And the key messages for today are that we are, this is just a continuation of the discussion to establish tools that will help provide early warning signs and help guide us as we develop our revenue strategies over the long term. They'll establish our dashboard metrics and developing these metrics so that we have, or this dashboard to provide guidance and early warning signs should we be veering off path. What that does is it enables us to accomplish any action that may be required over a longer period of time so that we can do it in small and incremental steps, which we have heard feedback from our customer owners that that's what they prefer, is those small incremental actions over time. And again, this is for planning purposes only and long-term forecasting assistance, but it doesn't impact the discretion of the board when ultimate action is necessary. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mark O'Brien to take it from here.
Thanks, Kelly. Just a quick overview here. Again, we've reviewed other business lines, water, wastewater, and fiber earlier this year. Again, as Kelly noted, we're going to move into more detailed discussion on integrated electric. And just to kind of give you a sense, we kind of break that down into the various operating components, one of those being kind of the retail segment, providing services to the county. We also have activity related to the long-term power contracts. Also, we have activity related to just the open market conditions, dealing with our SLICE program, and other just corporate-related activity that's housed underneath that umbrella of integrated electric, which comprises the large portion of the district's activity. So with that, just a quick review back. Back in Q1, we provided an update to the district's long-term forecast in terms of looking at liquidity. So as we look out in the future, our forecasts have declined as the market shifted down in those outer years. And so this graph depicted that adjustment to the new forecasted level, which is the dark blue line. Again, noting that out in the early 2020s, we're anticipating probably having to issue some debt to cover some of our expenditures. Again, we have a large capital program over the next decade, looking at Rock Island and other facility improvements. I would also note that even with that borrowing, which we currently forecast to be a little over $300 million through the duration out to 2027, we still maintain well below the existing debt leverage ratio that the district has established. And so even with that borrowing, we're well below that targeted threshold. So the district is sitting in a great position. Again, we do also monitor downside scenarios. So in the case here of the brown line, there is potentials for those positions to weaken even further. Thus, we would require us to issue debt even sooner and maybe take other actions beyond just debt issuance in those outer years. So that's just a quick overview of kind of that prior update that we provided the board. Along with that update, we also initiated breaking down integrated electric into the various components. So this next slide goes through each of those components, cost-based activity. These are the long-term contracts. Again, those are primarily based upon cost. So as our costs fluctuate, our revenues stay in alignment with those costs. That's associated with Puget, now COA. And we've got the market-based activity. This is going to be tied to our slicing program. So that activity really involves marketing energy at market rates over a short term as well as up to a five-year period and potentially even longer than that. And then, as I mentioned before, retail electric, that's providing service to the retail customer base. And you can see here the current forecast for 17 identifying bottom line expectations of each of those segments. And I would just note that the retail segment is the unique one here because it's actually operating at a loss. And so it is leveraging value from the district's wholesale program and enabling us to cover those other costs through that means. I would also just note, you can see the magnitude of the activity, whereas the integrated electric here is comprising most of the district's bottom line activity. whereas water, wastewater, and fiber are relatively neutral, basically push-type operations where we're meeting the expenses but not obtaining a lot of revenue beyond existing cost. The next slide kind of further expands on that breakdown, and we extend that out in five-year increments. So what we're looking at in 2022 and then out in 2027. Again, the key focus here is looking at that transition on the integrated electric components. As you can see, the market-based activity has a relatively steep decline in our current forecast. Again, relatively strong in 2017, adjusting down out in 2027 to about $21 million. Again, still positive results. So we do anticipate our market sales activity to still exceed cost, but that margin is shrinking. Cost-based activity, again, is relatively stable. Again, this is the cost-based contracts with some adders, and so that revenue stays relatively stable through the duration of the contracts. And then the retail electric, you can see the continued erosion on those results, and that's just driven by continued expansion of services, as well as increased cost, inflationary type increases, and we're assuming no rate increases during that duration at this point in time. So again, revenue stream staying relatively stable, but expenses continue to climb over time. So again, that takes us down to the kind of the focus of this discussion is looking more in detail at the integrated electric business line and determining what kind of guidance we want to put in place to help monitor that activity as we look out into the future. Any questions on that? So this is just a quick example looking at the retail electric component only. So again, this is that segment of our business providing service to the county customers. Just want to kind of show the comparison of where we're at today versus where we would be at 10 years out. Currently, our revenues are about $52 million, and that associates with a cost of about $69. So we're currently only covering about 75% of those costs through direct retail rates. Again, that other remaining portion is coming from surplus energy sales and the margins from those long-term power contracts. But as we look out 10 years out, that delta continues to increase. Retail revenues do go up, primarily just due to growth, customer growth and load growth, and so it's just above $60 million. But in that same duration, our costs are expected to be about $104 million. Again, that's looking at kind of the trending off of current inflationary impacts, as well as just increased cost of doing business. So a good example there would be related to, say, substations, where more effort, more work, more difficult to find locations. And so those costs are going up even higher than inflation in that example. So again, this is the area of focus as we move forward in our discussions to kind of look at what kind of guidance, what kind of parameters we would want to put in place to help monitor this situation so we can give early warning to the board when action may be required. So with that, just looking forward, coming back to the board in July and probably throughout the rest of the year, and the next step will be focusing in on what kind of policies that we can apply to help provide those early warnings. Again, the ultimate goal here is to try and determine that minimum revenue requirement, how much should our rates be covering in the long term, and when we might want to be adjusting those rates out in the future. Again, we don't anticipate a need for rate adjustments anytime soon, but we do want to get things in place, and so we can start communicating to the board when we get close to meeting those minimum requirements. These are just a couple examples of some thoughts related to potential metrics that we'll be bringing to the board in the near future. First one here is just looking at the overall retail operating cost and establishing some kind of coverage level. So like I said before, our current rates are covering about 75% of those costs. At what point in time do we want to maybe look at that a little deeper and identify maybe what is that minimum level that we need those revenue rates to cover? Again, so we don't, you know, push the decision process off too far, and so we get to a point where we have to take more dramatic action. and not a proactive approach to managing our rates. Another example is just to looking at the overall gap. Do we want to have a fixed level or some kind of inflationary adjusted level, minimizing that gap at some level? Another example would be to look at the district's overall surplus position. And so as that position changes, maybe the requirements need to change. And so if the surplus position weakens further, that may identify and trigger a more proactive approach to rates than otherwise would be needed. So those are just some concepts, and we will be discussing with the board over the next several board meetings to bring some of those discussions and look for guidance from the board as far as when is the right time to be looking at adjusting rates out in the future. So questions?
And maybe I can add before you have questions. We had that funny look on our face just now because this was our intention to give you that sneak peek into the bag of what we'll be talking about next time. But there's one other item here that didn't make it onto this version of the presentation. That's also just another idea of what we could look at and monitor is that wholesale revenue margin. So as you saw that slide 8 that shows the component of each item contributing to integrated electric, trying to identify different metrics that can help us make sure we stay in balance with each component of that. So we also had on here another idea for a sample metric was the wholesale revenue margin. So just wanted to have that one kind of working in the back of your mind too, because all of this was intended to give you a little bit of a chance to think about it, and then we'll dive deeper into the details when we're here at the next meeting.
Yeah, one thing I would add too, in looking at the existing policies we recently established for the other business lines, water, wastewater, and fiber, those particular metrics were similar to this first option here, where we are covering a certain percent of their operating cost. And so we're looking at just the operations, maintenance, and taxes, and covering those levels for those business lines. So that's an example of how we establish a requirement so we can monitor those revenues and rates, make sure they stay in alignment with those costs.
I have a question. Historically, on the difference between cost versus revenue, currently we're at roughly 75% coverage. Has that been fairly consistent in the past?
I would say that our last, we're covering all the costs, was probably back in 08, our last rate adjustment and rate effort. That was prior to long-term power contracts and really prior to the district having a lot of surplus energy. Because when those new power contracts went into play in 2011 and 12, not only were the terms improved, so they became more of a cost-plus type of a contract, we also retained a lot more of the surplus position. And so we shifted from, 15 to 20% of the overall portfolio to about half of it. And so once that took place, and that enabled the district to have those margins from those contracts and activity to basically supplement our current rates. And so over time, we've slowly increased costs, but those cost increases have been met by those additional revenues.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think an important piece of communication with the public is going to be when was really the last time we raised rates, and if there is a consideration, of that, what have been the components that have chewed away at that margin and, caused us to take a look, because there's going to be some automatic assumptions. If we go into a building program and raise rates, people are going to point fingers, which is basically doesn't have a lot to do with this decision. If it programs out over time, so it's just that whole communication piece and where we've been and where we are and, the one surplus or one surcharge we had for 18 months.
It was a little longer than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, in that 2009, 10, and 11 time period.
Yeah, and people understood that one. We're certain we were never going to take that away, and we did. And so in that vein of being authentic with you know, with our customers, I think we really need to, as we move, you know, any thoughts in this direction, to make sure public are aware that it's long-term thought.
And kind of following on that same train of thought, integrated electric is a new, kind of a new area for us to have mm-hmm. one more level down of detail of financial policies. And since it's a new area, we think that it might lend itself to just testing out some of these metrics too. So we have a resolution, for example, that guides us on our district-wide financial policies, and we have a really good feel for how those help us. Here, we're not exactly sure quite yet which will be the right metric, which will give us the best information and help with that early identification of when we may be straying off path with something that we want to keep on path with. So we also anticipate that this will be a trial and error, and we'll test some of these out, see what works the best, incorporate them into our quarterly reporting to the board, our quarterly financial updates, and we'll refine them as we see what works the best. So that will be a little different, too, than our normal process that we have, but it's because we're diving into more detailed territory. So I think that might be a really useful way to go about it.
Thank you. But Kelly, this will all be within the framework of our overarching four financial metrics that keep us in safe territory.
Yeah, this is a supplement to that, actually, because we still have our overarching ones in place. But sometimes things can be a little bit masked when you're looking at the big picture, because maybe a couple of the components are getting out of balance from where you would prefer them to be, but your overall results are still mm-hmm. where you want. So what we would like to do is that one more level down into those components, so we can also make sure that we're balancing the individual results mm-hmm. as well as the big picture. But definitely the overarching financial policies are still our main way that we look at overall results.
Right, and provide us, keep us from getting too far at the business level, at the lower level or the greater level of detail, keep us from getting too far off center.
Yeah, they do exactly. And maybe what I could describe a little better too is when we look at our market-based activity and our retail activity, we rely on both of those revenue streams to cover the costs of providing that retail service. And we don't want to get over-reliant on that market-based stream because it's the more unpredictable stream. So right now, we could use the example of, we're strong and stable, but you wouldn't be able to tell by looking at only the total if we're where we want to be in that balance. So the total does guide us, but we would also like to ensure that we are not getting unintentionally over-reliant on something that we don't want to.
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
I like having this metrics.
This is good work.
And I'd add one other thing, too. I think the overarching financial metrics left alone could easily lead us down the path away from the direction that our customers have said they want us to go. And by that, I mean could lead us down the path of where we would wait, and then have large rate increases as opposed to acting ahead of time, being proactive. So this additional guidance helps us to define when is it we should start talking about incremental increases that may be building towards avoiding that double-digit rate increases.
I'm going to have to go home and think about that. I don't see how that could get us that far off of our strategic goals and plans. But I'll think about it, and then I'll ask questions later.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think we got there.
Yeah. And I guess I have just a little input that small increases and not getting near a double digit would be really good. Mm-hmm. And over time, letting people adjust.
And for sure, and you've heard me say it before, but it's one of the things I really want to emphasize too is, and it's not any one of these metrics alone. We need to look at all of these things together. So one may be signaling something to us, but when we look at it in totality, that's when we really get the whole picture. So this is just an additional level of detail that will help us ensure that we are looking at all of those indicators together and having good information for overall decision making.
I have found this very helpful. You drill down, you get some numbers that really, certainly in the year 2027, could look very scary if we don't do anything in the meantime, particularly if we're counting on wholesale revenues, which appear to be declining. And so being a fan of small incremental increases, this has been really helpful. Thank you. Good stuff.
Thank you.
And just quickly review next steps. As I said before, we're planning to come back to the board. So we start working through and discussing some of those metrics, establish that guidance, in Q3, and then moving on to applying that guidance to kind of our long-term rate guidance plan, as well as looking at funding, debt funding strategies as well. So any other questions today?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate the update. Thanks. A lot of hard work went into those numbers. You make it look easy, but I know there's a lot of work that goes into it. So thanks.
So I think this might be the first time since I've been here that Eric's going to change seats. And
some might question the wisdom of letting the lawyer drive.
We've been giving some thought to delegation of authority here and ways that we might be able to achieve some efficiencies and also create some more focus for the board with respect to strategic issues. So we want to walk through some beginning a conversation with you about how we might address delegation of authority.
So good morning, commissioners. For the record, my name is Eric Walquist, General Counsel, Chief Compliance Officer, and as Steve suggested, purpose of today's presentation is really to begin a conversation with the board about delegated authorities. Over the past, in a way of setup, over the past year and a half or more, and you'll see in about two slides, the district's been, I'm going to say, undergoing a number of evaluative events causing us to look at the entire procurement and contracting process here at the district in an effort to identify opportunities to capture efficiencies and also to avoid missteps in that process. And that effort has caused us, as one point of interest, to evaluate or reevaluate the board's delegation of authority for signatures on contract and procurement documents. So today we'll start that conversation. I want to point out there is we're going to talk about really four overarching concept proposals for consideration, not for decision today, but really to start the thinking surrounding the board's delegation. And then we'll have a couple of slides on sort of the what we don't see changing, and then a couple of high-level issues that the board really is going to have to sink into some fairly deep thinking on near the end. And then some proposed timelines as we move forward. So moving through these slides, I will say I started with a promise to Steve there'd be about five slides, and I think I ended up with 15, so I was channeling my inner Kelly Boyd. Having said that, by way of background, so the board historically, certainly as long as I've been involved with the district since 1996 or so, and well before that, there have been delegations of board authority for procurement and contracting purposes to staff, really in an effort to capture efficiencies and avoid having to bring every contract action before the board for formal delegation. This is a common not only to Chelan PUD, but other PUDs throughout the state. Our current board delegation resolution is listed there at 081-3325. It is one I have with me and I keep next to me on my desk at all time because we actually have many, many questions, as you'll hear throughout this presentation, that come up in procurement contracting services, legal audit and compliance about who has what authority to sign what document. That updated delegation resolution in 08 was a result of a contracting process review and some recommendations that came out of that review. And as I mentioned earlier, recent events have caused us to look at the process and to try to identify some opportunities. These are just a few of the efforts that have undergone the more significant ones staff exercise in the last year and a half to 2 years. We have had, and the board has heard, a significant increase in the number of projects. We did have Dan Frazier come over as the new shared services director. He led a team that Felicity Saberhagen and Tracy Yunt participated in to look at the entire procurement and contracting process and come forward with recommendations given conversations with stakeholders, which was really valuable given that Dan was sort of new and able to bring that fresh objective perspective to the board's processes, and he could measure them against other municipal contracting processes since he's been a public employee before coming to the board with Quincy and the city of Wenatchee. We recently completed an internal audit of the PCS process review. PCS and legal, as part of all of these efforts, have actually been, I should have had audit to that as well, but we've been seeking different input, comment, feedback from all of the stakeholder users of the process, looking for clarity and recommendations. We actually reinstituted something that we had before that we stopped doing for a period of time, which is a contract development committee. We hold quarterly meetings, and those involve not only procurement or PCS legal compliance, but also the user groups, the energy engineering and project management groups, as well as the project managers from the hydro project, so we can talk about opportunities to improve our contracting documents and processes as a, at an administrative level that don't rise to the level of impacting board delegation. And then we also had a new effort. Those of you, I know I was kidding a bit earlier with Commissioner Arsenault about sitting on the beach in Hawaii and reading my 42-page, very informative tome on public contracting. We also instituted some new process training this year, PCS Legal and Engineering Project Management, and I want to thank Dan Frazier and Brett Bickford for working on me with that. And Brett actually took the laboring oar in terms of presentation, and it was process-focused and I think well-received by all the attendees. So out of all of those efforts, we did get a common set of themes in terms of how we can think about the current delegation resolution and where we might find opportunities to change those delegated authorities for signature and come up with some additional efficiencies. And these are really the four primary ones. There will be detailed changes for language more than anything, I assume, but these will be the four overarching themes. One, simplify the delegation resolution and reduce the need to identify each document based upon a transactional distinction. Delegate the authorities that are currently delegated legislatively by the board through resolution administratively to the general manager so that he can redelegate those authorities below him. Keep a clean chain of command. We'll talk about some of that. Create a clear process for redelegation so that we know definitively where to go and look to see who has what authorities, and then to consider the delegation of routine contract acceptance and closeout. So my plan is to go through as quickly as possible each of those with a current state and a proposed state at a concept level, and then we'll end, as I suggested, with a couple of what won't change slides. So simplify and reduce transactional distinctions. Our current challenges, we basically, under the current delegation authority, have signature authorities delegated based upon the type of contract document, not the overall contract value that's being committed by the district. So I refer to those as transactional authorities and transactional distinctions, and we have some interesting results. Some of the same individuals have different and actually potentially conflicting signature authorities depending upon the nature of the transaction. We spend a lot of staff time answering questions about which bucket of authority does the particular document or transaction fall into so we can identify the right signature authority. Not all the transactions, believe it or not, are contemplated and clearly fit in one bucket. Some of those that I've listed here are those that we've actually struggled with here in the last 6 months or so as part of the board presentation and agenda. And then the last one is one that's near and dear to my heart, which is there is a tremendous amount of time that the board does not see tracking down who has what signature authority for contract documents. As we go through this, I'll tell you that we're not proposing to change the total delegated authority to Steve. So the easy solution to the spending a lot of time is to send everything to Steve's desk for signature, but he doesn't care for that either and pushes back on it. So the proposal that I'm making would be to move from the transactional document-by-document-based approach to a contract value or commitment approach. So this is an effort to set some delegated signature authorities based upon contract value in total up to particular thresholds that Steve and the board would be comfortable with so that people would know that they could sign contract documents until the total value of the contract commitment made by the district exceeds X dollars, and then it would need to elevate to the next signature authority level. Does that make sense? I think that will address all of these conflicting and troublesome issues we talked about in the last slide, and we won't have multiple signature authorities, contract buckets to examine, etc. The big capture here will be that last bullet, which is great efficiency in terms of the time staff spends analyzing who has what signature authority. The second overarching theme was that we should delegate administratively instead of legislatively. So the current delegation resolution actually has the board delegating past the general manager directly to staff, and we've seen some of the issues associated with this. I've given you a couple of those potential conflicts here. It does set up the possibility of some of the redelegated authorities not being communicated up the chain of command, so that senior management knows of all the documents that are being signed. It also creates the potential for inconsistent redelegation. I don't know if any of you are aware of this, but under the current delegated authority, some of those delegated levels that you've made to senior management, you also permit redelegations by senior management to lower level management based upon their trust and confidence relationships with their staff. The problem is there's no requirement that that be done uniformly, so we actually have different levels of redelegation potentially, and some don't delegate at all. And those, as you can imagine, become difficult to track, and then when they're rescinded because of staff changes and so forth, sometimes those don't always get updated on all of the places that they live out there on our internet, and in some of us old school folks still pin memos to the wall. So the other issue is, because it's legislatively done, any change that we want to make to any of those delegations or redelegations must be done by resolution. We need to come back to the district's legislative body, that's the board, to make those changes. Similarly, if there's anything that's not in there that is clearly addressed, we need to come back for clarity to the board. Finally, and this is important, I always remind myself of it, is all of that staff time that we talked about earlier where we advise people about who has what signature authority, that's all really good advice. We try to do the best we can, but it isn't certainty. The only way we would get absolute clarity is to come back to the board and ask you. And you can imagine how much time we would take on your board agenda if we brought all of those back to you. In addition, we would have delays in the contracting authorities that we would need to be executing. So the proposal is for the board to directly delegate to the general manager and permit redelegation by the general manager up to some thresholds that are comfortable to the board. And I've given you, I think this addresses the issues we talked about on the last slide. That last bullet point is very important to me, and I think to all of those of us that give advice on these, is if we have changes that need to be made, we need clarification, we need other conditions maybe on the exercise of delegated authority, it's much easier to go directly to the general manager and to amend a redelegation memo and provide clarity or condition than it is coming back to the board every time that that's necessary. The third that I spoke about in terms of overarching themes is to create a clear process for redelegation and tracking. A lot of that lack of clarity grows out of the board delegation versus management redelegation. It's not the delegation itself that provides the problem. It's how those delegated authorities are redelegated and then where they're tracked, which website they are posted to, and do we all have consistent interpretation of what those memos mean? Some of which I will tell you go to PCS and I don't see. Others probably come to me and PCS doesn't see. So there's no definitive location where we can look at a delegated memo, look at a spreadsheet of delegated authorities, and know that if it's there, you have it, and if it's not, you don't. And so we want to create that by this proposal. The general manager only would be allowed to redelegate. It would be done by memorandum, be delivered to my office, where we would be responsible, given my direct reporting relationship with the board, for posting that so that it is the final word on who has what delegated authorities as redelegated by the general manager's memo. I would be, or my office would be, responsible for updating and ensuring that whatever is posted is current. If it isn't there, you don't have it. And then, obviously, along with my compliance obligation, if we see any substantial problems associated with that, we would need to address them first administratively with Steve. And if we couldn't come to some conclusion or we had some lack of comfort about a particular issue, come back to the board for clarity. The fourth and final overarching theme is to consider the redelegation of routine contract acceptance and closeout documents. So This really relates to contracts over $300,000. Small works are actually handled in another resolution, and those don't come before the board. But currently, all contracts over $300,000 for closeout come to the board. We do lessons learned. In those documents, you ratify change orders. Those change orders have already actually been issued. The work's already been complete. So you're effectively administratively rubber stamping something that's already been done. The dates for completion of work are based more on the board meeting dates and when the board takes action than they are the actual contract completion and work completion dates. And it doesn't matter whether the contract or the project is on time or over budget, it still comes before the board. These resolutions for final acceptance often get moved to consent, so they're not addressed. Believe it or not, that last bullet, staff just doesn't come into the board meeting ready to go. We actually have a lot of effort going in not only to the preparation of the resolutions and the memorandums and business cases associated with those, but we have a presentation, pre-board presentation meeting on Monday before the board meeting, and then we have a pre-agenda on Wednesday. So there's a lot of staff time involved. And then you have, of course, staff sitting in the audience here waiting for the resolution to be called.
Eric, a question on the completion of the project and then the amount of time that it takes to get to the board for approval, that delays payment to the contractor. Yes, no?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, it delays payment in terms of, the work isn't accepted and finally complete. There might be other, depending upon the contract, payments and trigger dates, milestone payments and the like. But in terms of final payment, and important to many contractors, that retainage release, you'll recall the district is statutorily required to keep 5% of the contract value back for retainage to cover lien claims, et cetera. So that retainage release date triggers from the board's acceptance of the resolution. So, yes.
But it could.
It does delay that.
If this proposal goes through, that retainage could be released at that point?
So, actually, what happens at that point is we start the process of the release of retainage. Required to release it within 45 days of the final acceptance. The important date that starts, though, is we begin to track any claims against that retainage and get assurances from the state agencies and subcontractors that they've all been paid, that the taxes have been paid, and there aren't any claims. So it's not that date, but yes, it would certainly start that clock and those efforts sooner.
Yeah, which could improve relationships with contractors.
It could. We like our contractors.
Yes, we do.
So the proposal is to consider delegating the acceptance of routine contract and contract closeout. Some of these are conditions. We need to set a threshold below which we would do that redelegation. There would be a threshold above which we would still have the board do that. The proposal would be that we would only do that similarly for contracts that came in on schedule or ahead of schedule and on or under budget. We could still post or present lessons learned depending upon what those lessons learned are and grow out of the contract work. We would need to ensure that there was a fashion that the board would certainly be advised as to what contracts had been completed, and if they had any questions about the contract specifically or the lessons learned, we could make decisions about what to present. So we would need to develop that reporting. And the time capture here is all that time spent by staff that we discussed in the prior slide would, in theory, be recaptured and refocused into other productive work. So I promised, what won't change? So the delegation resolution in 08 actually delegates authorities for a number of different things related to procurement and contracting services. But the proposals that we're bringing forward really would relate to just that section, candidly, sections 3 and 4 under the current delegation resolution related to signature of contract and contract-related documents. We're not proposing to change the maximum delegation to the general manager. Currently, delegated authority goes to Steve for contracting and procurement at $3 million, in excess of $3 million. It needs to come before the board for approval to advertise and for award. Not proposing to change that amount. What we're really trying to do is change administratively how folks below Steve figure out what authority they have to sign. So I mentioned earlier that the board's already given the delegated authority that, for the most part, we're asking for. There's a couple exceptions on the next slide. We're just talking about administratively how we distribute that below in a way to increase efficiency and reduce confusion. Commissioner, do you have a question?
You're not. I'll wait till you get there.
All right.
You might answer my question.
So the second bullet that I've given you there is a section in the delegation resolution related to procurement and contracting that relates to equipment leases. So that is currently given at $1 million to Steve, and we're not proposing to change that. It was still there. It would just, as the first bullet, really administratively redistribute and clarify who has the authority to sign documents below that. So, again, I wanted to point out this is signature authority. It does not replace, delegate, or change any of the internal risk and decision-making controls and processes that we have in place. Before any of the projects are brought forward, there's obviously a capital budget and budget established. There are business cases and there are decision-making criteria that we go through as a senior team. Many of them get presented to the board even when we don't have resolutions as informative measures. Those would not change. Further, the broad bucket of what I call and the board delegation calls exception contracts that currently require board approval would still require board approval. So these are the emergencies, the sole sources, the declaration of no bids and authorization of negotiation, the execution of interlocal agreements, grants and loans, they remain the same. And all of the current board reporting requirements continue. One of the conversations we'll need to have going forward is whether, depending upon the decision-making that grows out of this conversation, we need to change or add additional board reporting. I didn't get there, did I?
Well, this kind of goes back quite a ways. The sole source, the exception contract?
Yes.
I think that goes way back to a previous commissioner who, for some reason, really had an issue with sole source contracts. And so they really became a focus for the board. But we have been bringing those forward and talking about them and looking at them. I have for 10, 11, right. 12 years, and I totally trust. I understand the whole concept. I understand why it's sole source. I just question whether we really need to make that an exception anymore. I know the history of it, but, you know, I may be the only one that feels that way.
So I'll make that note. And we'll continue to capture that thought as we go forward with the conversation about what is or isn't appropriate to include. I'll supplement your comments, Commissioner Kung, by saying that, yes, there's quite an internal process for sole source declarations that staff follows before it even hits the board. Mm-hmm. The statute, as you probably know, requires certain assurances and certifications from our proposed contractor under the sole source. These are some of the things you see in the resolutions associated with lowest price. They're offering us the lowest price for similarly situated customers. They certify that they are the sole source for whatever it is that we are trying to procure. So there's actually a memorandum that needs to be prepared by staff to document that analysis in support of board resolution before it's brought. So, yeah, there is a process, and I'll make note of that to continue the conversation.
Yeah, so I absolutely trust that really that internal process. I don't know, Dennis, you've been here longer than the other two. How do you feel about that? Do you have any issues with the sole source?
A little bit of mixed emotion. You know, I think it's, I do trust staff, and I do think we're on a different course than we were at one point, and I appreciate that very much. It's really hard with the process that Eric's talking about for any kind of collusion or anything else to take place. So I'd probably be more in your camp.
So if it's okay, I'll make note of it, and we'll add it to the list of items for future discussion and decision-making.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I call this the would or could change slide, which is there are a couple of buckets that are created in the current delegation resolution that we have to make, or the board needs to make some decisions about. The first of those, and it's frankly because they are, they're broken out separately and handled with different delegated thresholds. The first is service agreements. Under the current board delegation resolution, service agreements come before the board if they are in excess of $200,000 or for follow-up action if some amendment or extension of a service agreement causes it to go over $200,000. So that could change. The proposal could sweep service agreements into all other contract documents, and you have a singular cap at the $3 million with three delegated authorities below that. Or we could continue to treat them separately under a new delegation resolution at some other threshold. Irrespective of which way we do that, the other proposed changes, I think, would still apply to that so that we would have similar treatment. So if we kept a $3 million for all contracts, but let's say had a $500,000 for service agreements or even the current $200,000, all of the follow-on pieces of delegation and redelegation would be the same. So there would be a consistent application of those across the board. So that's a decision point the board's going to have to talk about. The other is field work order change orders. Currently, field work order change orders come before the board for action when they're in excess of $500,000 or when they add more than 25% of the contract value to the contract. Again, we can continue to treat those separately, or we can sweep those into the total contract commitment at $3 million. I will tell you that field work order change orders create the single most amount of resource commitment internally to figure out how we calculate those percentages and whether we should bring them forward. On the earlier slide, dealing with proposed change, I can't recall which one actually without looking at it, and I won't bother you with it, but we do have field work order, change order commitment levels that create confusion. Some of those you've seen recently are things like, what happens when we have eight of them, but the net result is a $2 million total contract reduction? Those still have to come before the board if any of those contract change orders is over $500,000. You recently saw that, right? So we're going to have to do some thinking about change orders. Service agreements and change orders, I will tell you, one of the issues associated with this that we're going to need to talk about is whether or not the board needs to act on those or whether the board needs additional reporting so that you maintain your transparency, oversight, visibility, responsibilities associated with your office. So we could talk about that. I can't really think of a field work order change order or a service agreement that I can recall seeing that wasn't approved or that didn't go to even consent. So certainly having you aware of what's happening is important, but maybe not the need to actually act on those. So these are just issues to think about as we move forward. Commissioner.
Comment, yeah. For some reason, I like seeing the change orders. Not necessarily, like you say, we probably haven't acted on any of those. They seem to be a flashpoint for some people and some of our customers and some of our people who bid and contractors. So that's just my feeling. I like seeing them.
And that's actually one of the things I'd ask you all to consider is it an awareness issue or a decision issue? If it's a reporting issue, then there's a way we can supplement current reporting so that you see all of those. Maybe you're satisfied. Maybe you aren't. Maybe we need to actually act and decide. Some of the challenges that acting creates as opposed to visibility is we are waiting then on project work until we can get it prepared and come before the board for resolution. And some of our projects don't really sit well with waiting 2 weeks in terms of delay. So these are all issues that we're just introducing as a concept. We'll discuss the details of and challenges of as we move along. I've already talked to you about the current proposal. You would not see certain final acceptance resolutions below a proposed threshold, so we'd need to figure out the right reporting. And that's the last slide, or the last bullet, which is in all of these cases, as we go through our conversation, I'd ask you to continue to consider what kind of reporting under the current reporting process do you like and is informative, and what might we do to supplement any information to give you that informed view of district operations if we make any of these changes. It's difficult for me in my position to tell you what's useful to you. You're going to need to help us understand what's valuable to you, Commissioner, as you just suggested. Yeah, next
and,
steps.
And just so the board is aware, I shared this morning my concern about change orders with Eric. So there's some thought we need to put into that one.
So in terms of next step, once we get through these concept proposals, if there are showstoppers for you, please let me know as soon as you can. If there are not showstoppers, then we will begin, I will begin with Steve's help and other staff input to work toward proposed revisions to the current delegation resolution. We'll work on the redelegation memorandum. Those things need to go hand in glove. We can't have a resolution authorizing redelegation without also at the same time the redelegation memo, so we don't have a hitch in our giddy-up in terms of signing contracts. Going to have to look into what the posting procedures will be And then we'll come back with some of those thoughts on the details to the board for additional conversation and discussion and take your feedback on those items. And ultimately, at the end of this conversation, I've not put a date on it because I think it's an iterative process. We'd have a new delegation resolution. I'm over my 15 minutes. Questions about that? Commissioner?
So given my prior professional background, this is an ongoing issue between a communication issue between board, general manager, and staff. And it's always this constant who has the authority to do what, who, not only the authority, but then the responsibility and accountability. And so the board always wants to know, always wants to be accountable. CEO always wants to be accountable. Staff always want to be accountable. And it appears to me that what we're doing here is providing the CEO, there doesn't seem to be much change here other than some dialogue on change orders. And maybe we can figure out how that communication best occurs back to us. I think we're interested in seeing when change orders come, just as anybody else does. But it seems like what we're trying to do here is to be allowing the general manager more latitude to do what we've directed in the first place, and that's to communicate that process of authority and signature. And so I haven't seen anything here that looks like it changes us letting go. It provides more opportunity to provide, I think, less micromanagement, but as long as we're having the authority or the ability to monitor what's going on through communication back to us and reports, et cetera, quarterly reports, ongoing change orders, those type of things, it doesn't look like much has changed there. So I feel comfortable with where that's going and look forward to, I look forward anytime you, through communication and written procedures and policy, that you can communicate who's got the authority to do what. I think it creates more efficiencies in the organization.
Thank you, Commissioner. Certainly bringing clarity would help. I should say, should have said, that one of the nice things about an administrative delegation and redelegation is that the memo from the general manager delegating or redelegating those authorities up to the limits that he and she or the board think are appropriate, you can also draft into that memorandum all of those checks on authority, the boxes you have to check before you can exercise that authority, the preconditions to that authority, the procedures and process in terms of what's required before you sign a document. So we can set all of those protocol protections up in the memo, and the nicety of the administrative delegation is if something isn't working or we need more, we need a change, it's a change in a delegation memorandum, an administrative function, as opposed to a legislative change. So it allows us to fine-tune the equalizer as we go if we need to address things. I would, just for clarity's sake, say the only two items really that the board would be giving up in terms of additional authority is the service agreement and the field board quarter change.
Commissioner Conner?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Steve.
I think what I'm trying to get at is, as a board member, I would rather provide direction to the organization on more efficient communication versus worried about and feel good about that versus feeling like I'm just rubber stamping that comes through on a consent agenda.
Understood.
I don't like that feeling, but I certainly don't want to abdicate my authority to those that have elected
anyway, I look forward to that work. I think it's a good one.
Commissioner Congdon.
So, yeah, so that's always been the challenge, and we've struggled with that forever on the spectrum of rubber stamping all the way to micromanaging, trying to find the balance and where we fit, where we're supposed to be. So I think that's always going to be a challenge to find that sweet spot. But anyway, I love this because I am always, scratching my, maybe it's just me, but I can never remember what those authorities are exactly and what the threshold, what that number is. And so if it could just be cleaned up and more concise, and if you could give us a one-page memo document that says, that just, spells it out at the high level, I'd love that. That would be really helpful.
I'll take that on.
Yeah, and I just don't want our employees getting caught in the crosshairs of confusion, and if we can develop a cleaner system that's more efficient and less intrusive, let's do it.
Thank you. Other questions?
Good work.
Thank you, commissioners.
Hey. We're ahead of schedule.
We are.
Do we have any manager items, Steve, that we could cover?
We do. We had quite a few, actually. So this is an opportunity for us to address.
Should I text Randy and let him know?
And I'm just looking around because we've trying to figure out which things we can do. I'm going to ask John Stoll to start with an update on Leavenworth substation.
Morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Yes, Leavenworth substation siting effort continues to move forward. We recently received a little more deeper engineering and cost estimating for the four sites that we have on the table in the Leavenworth area. And just as a reminder, we have the one off Chumstick, we have the city site, and then we have kind of Mend option one, Mend option two. So we have those results. Staff is now doing a dive into those feasibility reports and looking at them. We anticipate coming back to the board on the 10th with more information around these sites for your input as well. And at the same time, we're coordinating with the community group how best to present that information back to the community. At this point, we're looking at potentially doing a city council meeting update on the 11th. So that would be the Tuesday after the board meeting. So generally, they're around 6:30 to 7, I believe, when we've been on the docket. So we just wanted to give you a heads up that we're trying to work on that. I don't believe we have confirmation yet from the city that that will work, but they've been very accommodating in the past. So at this point, more to come on the 10th, and then again, we'll go back out in the community as well.
Good.
That's good.
Thank you.
Good update. Thanks, John.
A few other things here. Number one, would like you to know that we had a really good week last week with respect to hydro relicensing issues. First of all, on our early action credit language, there was a letter that came from Senator Cantwell and Representative Frank Pallone, who is the ranking member of the Energy and Commerce Committee from New Jersey, of all places, endorsing the early action credit language. So last year, you may recall that we were successful in getting it included in the Senate bill. The House bill did not include it, but we felt like we were doing well in terms of the conference report, and then the conference committee was not able to come to resolution on the overall bill. So this was an important step for us to hear that the ranking minority member was also supportive of that language. So we're really pleased by the work that's been done there. Second, we've expanded our activities here and have engaged more broadly on hydro relicensing issues this year. And last week, the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee, the Energy Environment Subcommittee, passed a hydro relicensing bill.
So we have been waiting to see what strategy would be adopted. Would they try to deal with hydro relicensing as part of a comprehensive approach to energy legislation generally? Might it be attached to infrastructure legislation? The Senate has just in the last month begun to indicate that they are interested in moving forward with an energy bill of some kind that would definitely include the hydro relicensing provisions. The House had been an open question for us as to how that was going to move forward. The provision that moved forward is sponsored by Kathy McMorris Rogers, who has been tremendously accessible to us. And the early action credit language is included in that, as well as some other provisions, which we have felt are important. So we're pleased with that. There also is an attempt to move the bill forward on a bipartisan basis. And we have been active on that front as well, seeking to try to find potential members in the Northwest delegation who would be willing to be supportive of hydro licensing. And we've had some success on that as well in terms of being able to not just identify members, but have them commit to take action to support relicensing. So really good week. And of course, we all know this is a really long process that has a lot of hurdles along the way. But there was a point earlier this year, we weren't even sure that hydro licensing would be addressed by the Congress. And we're now seeing action and action that is in a direction that we believe would be beneficial for anyone doing going through the hydro licensing process.
Sounds like you have quite a bit more traction going.
We do. Yeah, we're really excited by what we've seen in the last 10 days and thinking that this is beginning to look like it has a chance.
Good.
Another item. So last week, I represented both Chelan and the Large Public Power Council at the annual FERC conference on the state of reliability and particularly the implementation of the reliability standards. There were four components of my oral statement. The written statement went into more pieces. The first had to do with how a risk-based approach to reliability compliance management is moving forward. The basic comment there was that the work that we have done in terms of inherent risk assessment and internal controls evaluation, we believe, has been beneficial. It has certainly been beneficial to reliability. But one thing that we haven't seen that we had hoped to see was some efficiency gains. As you know, because you've approved a lot of the increases in FTE and other costs associated with compliance management, this continues to be an expensive business to be in. Mm-hmm. And we have been asking for ways that we could use inherent risk assessment to identify areas where it may be that an individual entity does not have much impact on the BES in terms of compliance with an individual standard, and that those should be evaluated, and there should be more discretion given to the regional entities like the Western Electric Coordinating Council to be able to identify those places where there may not be much value in the documentation that we're doing and be able to reduce the documentation. Acting Chairman LaFleur picked up on that comment, and there was a bit of an extended discussion about that. Jerry Cawley, who is the head of the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, said he was not in support of that proposal. But in a conversation with him later, he believes that that authority may already exist and that it's not being used enough by the regional entities. So we have a follow-up item to see if we can make some progress there. This goes back to a commitment that I think that our discussion with the board 2 years ago about can't we find some ways to try to get some more efficiency out of this reliability compliance activity? And so we at least got it on the screen at the national level now, and we'll see how successful we are at being able to accomplish any of that. There was also a discussion of introducing cost-effectiveness standards to reliability compliance. Are we actually getting enough value relative to the individual standards? And NERC did indicate that they are interested in revisiting that. Very specific concerns around supply chain. There are new orders coming out about supply chain, about how utilities will manage supply chain. We are very concerned that about our ability to be able to actually manage vendors' processes. This is particularly with respect to cybersecurity. to be able to manage what goes on inside the vendor's process to assure that malware doesn't get in it and that we in the utility industry might become liable, including financially liable, if there was malware that on a system that we procured, had asked for a broader conversation with the Department of Energy and the Department of Homeland Security about that, which Department of Energy supported during the course of the hearing. And finally, talked about the California Renewable Portfolio Standards expansion and the risk to all of us with respect to the oversupply problems that are caused by RPS and the lack of a long-term strategy to address oversupply conditions and the potential risk with the in terms of the afternoon ramp, and do we have enough resources online in order to be able to deal with the afternoon ramp? Worked with the California ISO to coordinate those comments as well, so that they were not a shot at them, but more of a we need to be working together to solve this problem. So good session, good opportunity for us to get the issues that we think are important. The purpose behind this conference is to strategically discuss between FERC, NERC, and the industry what should be the priority areas for the next year for reliability issues. And it was a good opportunity to be able to get our issues on the table.
Steve, is there a recognition? Do you hear a recognition of these oversupply problems and this PM ramp issue in California? I mean, are the California legislators, the utility people, are they admitting to that? That's creating issues?
I think certainly amongst the California Independent System Operator and the Public Utilities Commission and the California Energy Commission, there is an acknowledgement of the issue, and there certainly is a growing understanding at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission about it. Whether that carries over to the California legislature is not clear, because we still see proposals coming out of the California legislature that seem to be less concerned about it than what we see from the industry.
Moving to 100% RPS.
Yeah, right.
Where we can't even, how they manage at 50%, they haven't figured that out.
It seems like there's such a extreme dichotomy between the legislature, which has control over some aspects of electricity in California, and then the ISOs. And it seems like there's a dysfunctional link there that makes it difficult for any kind of progress going forward.
It certainly is worrisome to us, and it's probably one of the primary reasons that we're concerned about a regional transmission organization that has a governance structure that's tied back to the California legislature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember Michelle Bertolini at your panel discussion at the NWPPA conference. Mm-hmm. And you were all asked, the CEOs were asked, and she's a CEO at a California utility, what keeps you up at night? And that was her one comment, was California legislators going to do next?
I am also among those who worry quite a bit about that because of the California market being such a big part of the Western market. Mm-hmm. Any other questions about that?
No, we're glad you're there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll do another one. So we've talked briefly before about the fact that the hourly coordination agreement is due to expire on July 1st of this year, and that Grant Chalanan have entered into an agreement that provides an extension for 18 months. The Douglas had not signed that agreement and wanted to put in place what's called the extraction early, so we were not trying to accomplish it over a weekend or late at night. And so that went into effect middle of last week, and it seemed to be accomplished relatively smoothly. A lot of work on the part of all three utilities to at least get through the first few days, and so we'll now watch to see how things go from there. I'll just ask, I know Kirk was watching this while I was out last week. Is there anything that you want to add to that?
Okay. Steve, a question on that is, you know, we got through this one pretty well, but we also have excess flow still. What if this was September, October, November? Does that change the intensity of that decision?
I don't think that we have reason to believe that necessarily it will be a problem. We had relatively high flows last week, although they were moderating towards the end of the week. The coordination, communication is really the key.
Yeah.
So, it may not be formal coordination, but it's still the informal coordination and communication is the key. And Douglas has indicated to us, at least, that they remain committed to there being great communication. And that will certainly determine how successful we are.
Okay, thank you.
I do want to mention, I know the board is generally aware that we had really some significant move on Columbia River Treaty last week over the course of the last 10 days. And we have been seeking that there be a more senior, more experienced diplomat placed in charge of the Columbia River Treaty discussions and have also advocated for the at least, if nothing else, the planning for, although we would like to move beyond planning, to issuing the 10-year notice provision for termination of the power provisions of the treaty. So we've been informed that, in fact, the State Department has decided to hire a more senior person. We've been told that now may happen as early as the early July, first week in July sometime. We don't know who that person will be yet, but we understand that they're pretty close in terms of identifying that person publicly. So that would be a huge step forward. We think that would be very beneficial. And we have heard, although we have not seen a written confirmation of this, that signals have been sent to all of the regional parties and to the Canadians that the U.S. government is going to begin to look at the process for issuing the 10-year notice provision. So that would be a very significant step in terms of a signal to the Canadians of the seriousness of the U.S. about the need to make changes and modifications to the power provisions of the treaty. There was a letter that went out from about a half dozen House members last week. I think it was about four Republicans, two Democrats, to the president, indicating that the termination notice should be considered and that it was important to move the negotiations forward, that the delays have become too long. So it's been a while since we've seen that kind of progress in this, and I've been tired of reporting red to you on this side of my own performance plan. And I'm not sure, I'm not ready to move it off of red, but it might move to yellow sometime soon because we're actually seeing some activity there. I think that might be it for what we can accomplish now. We have a couple of others where we need to get some folks in the room to be able to do the reports.
Okay. Well, it's a little bit early, but do you want to start early or do you want to just start at 1?
I think because it's always possible that we might have I think we should start
just
at 1.
Good, start at 1.
Just have okay. Too many people that need to come into the room.
I have a suggestion.
Yes.
I just have one quick comment for commissioner items. Do we want to?
We can cover
squeeze in commissioner items. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. A friend of mine who's a fellow Manson Kiwanian had a near miss accident with a truck and. She was quite certain it was a PUD truck, and she was driving somewhere in the Manson area, and she said this truck pulled out, didn't see her, pulled out in front of her. Anyway, so she called the Chelan office and was told, well, the PUD, this was a red truck, they asked her. And she was told this, well, we don't have red trucks, but, that was the extent of it. And so, she wasn't hurt. She didn't hit the truck, but she was upset. She was rattled. And so then apparently she called down here. This was last week and talked with Karen Welton. And Karen, she said, was just an absolute sweetheart. She spent so much time with her, worked with her. And, Karen, too, said in her mind, she's thinking, well, we don't have any red trucks. But she worked with her and spent time with her. And then she had her call Craig Weddle. right? Did I say his name? Mm-hmm. I did. I mean, I know Craig, and I know what he looks like. Craig, and Craig was the same way. He spent a lot of time with her, and she just raved. I saw her at Kiwanis, and she raved and raved about how wonderful they were and how helpful they were. And even though it turns out, she said, I'm very embarrassed. It wasn't, you know, obviously it was a county truck. It wasn't a PUD truck after all. I'm very embarrassed about that. But she just wanted me to let somebody know. And I said, well, I'll make a public statement that they were just both so terrific to deal with. So kind and so helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, that is good. And they both have Chelan County on the side, you know, in the logo.
The emblems, yeah.
Yeah. So.
Any other commissioner items while we're on the topic?
Just report coming back from my first APPA national conference was quite an enlightening event. Came with some very specific learnings about security that, and actually I should preface this, as a school superintendent, the worst fear you have as a manager is that your board members come back with new harebrained ideas. take you off on new strategies. So I'm just stating for the record that I didn't come back with any harebrained ideas.
The general manager is promising his staff that that he might not have brought them. So.
The correlation is that your staff is hoping you didn't come back with any.
So, but it was really interesting. You know, some sessions you go to are really good, others are not so good, and they don't meet your needs, and so you just need to excuse yourself. But if you come away with some really, you know, one or two really good ideas that reinforce your work, and I think the one thing that I came away with that was very practical was the whole notion of security, and I see that we're going to be talking about some upgrades that we're going to be making to our closed camera, so that just seemed to be real timely for me. And then the other thing is that we had kind of a futurist, an economist that was there talking about the whole changing of the world and how, and it just really challenged how we look at the world and how the population's moving and the importance of agriculture and economics and where the United States plays a role. I'd like to say I came away with a million great ideas, but I came away with what did I just learn and what were the implications, and it was staggering, you know, as it pertains to immigration and economics. And we also got to listen to captain of the USS Cole that was attacked by ISIS years ago. Really listened to a very inspirational speech and talk from him on how the importance of, you know, it doesn't matter how much planning you do, you just don't know what you don't know and when something's going to hit you and, you know, the courage it takes to react. And it was very sobering and very, what I thought, very applicable to power nationwide and the important work that people are doing. So I came away just very impressed with our staff and our management and the work that we're doing. And it was quite impressive to hear from him. That was it for me.
Tremendous value at the conferences, and of course some of the world-class speakers that they bring in really do create thought processes and bring that home and take a look at the empowerment of our staff and our general manager and how he's running this organization. And it just reaffirms the trust that you have in all the staff. Very good.
Nope.
Nothing else?
Nope. Good.
You know, I did identify a couple of the things we could get done this morning.
Good.
That's okay.
All right.
Want to invite Suzanne Hartman up on a motion for the board. Proposed motion.
Good morning, Commissioners. Suzanne Hartman, Manager of Communications at Chelan PUD. And while Teresa's getting my little prompter up on the screen, I think all of you have received an invitation excuse me, to come to the Apple Sox game Thursday night, and I hope I get to see all or most of you there. It should be a really fun event, and it's also Julio Cruz Day in not only Wenatchee but in Chelan County, and those were that was proclaimed by both the city and the county. And so, since Julio is going to be throwing out the first pitch for Chelan County PUD night at the Apple Sox, we thought it would be appropriate that we proclaim and declare Thursday, June 29th, Julio Cruz Day at Chelan PUD. So I'm going to read this for you. I don't have 15 slides, Eric, and so I'll try to be quick. But Julio Cruz, the speedy Seattle Mariners second baseman from 1977 to 1983, and now Seattle Mariners Spanish station radio broadcaster, is coming to Wenatchee, Washington on Thursday, June 29th, to be part of Chelan PUD night at the Wenatchee Apple Sox game. In fact, he will throw out the first pitch for the game. Julio was born in Brooklyn, New York, and went to college at San Bernardino Valley College and entered the Major League Farm System with the California Angels. His Major League debut was with the Seattle Mariners on July 4, 1977. Known for his great speed, Julio held the Seattle Mariner career stolen base record of 290 stolen bases, averaging more than 40 stolen bases per year, until that record was broken in 2008 by Ichiro. Cruz, or the Cruiser, or Juice, as he was known, had 343 career stolen bases. He went on from Seattle Mariners to Chicago White Sox, but we'll forgive him for that. Julio has been an inspiration and mentor to many young ball players, especially within the Hispanic community, and will spend time on Thursday, June 29th with Wenatchee area kids to talk about baseball and probably how to steal a base. Both the city of Wenatchee and Chelan County have declared Thursday, June 29th, Julio Cruz Day. The action is, it is proclaimed by the Commission of Public Utility District Number 1 of Chelan County, Washington, as follows. The Chelan PUD Commissioners, in recognition of Chelan PUD Night at the Wenatchee Apple Sox, declare Thursday, June 29, 2017, Julio Cruz Day at the PUD, urging customer owners and PUD employees to join Julio at the Paul Thomas Ballpark before 7:05 p.m., to join the festivities.
So, commissioners, we've actually prepared a proclamation number one for the board, and all we would need is a motion if the board is so inclined to proclaim June 29th, 2017, Julio Cruz Day. And then, assuming that would pass, there is a written proclamation that we can post.
It's not proper in terms of Robert's Rules of Order, but instead of repeating all of that, I move that we do Julio Cruz proclamation.
I second the motion.
It's been moved and seconded. Any questions, comments, discussion? Hearing none, so moved.
He has been getting tremendous coverage by the Mariners lately, yeah. And I can't imagine that's not going to help the turnout that night.
I hope so.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a great guy. He's a lot of fun. I hope you have a chance to meet him. And Commissioner Arsenault is gracious enough. He's going to be introducing him to the Wenatchee Rotary on Thursday at their lunch. So
I thought Commissioner Arsenault might be receiving the first pitch.
Well, maybe.
Oh, no.
That would guarantee attendance.
There.
Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you.
I could do one other quick thing, too, which would also help me just to make sure that we're okay for the follow-up on board action items. So we had two from last time. One of them is not something we'll be reporting on regularly, but just to acknowledge that we committed to get back to you on the RFP process for AMI in advance of that, so you know what the issues are that'll be included in that RFP process, and particularly the opt-up option to try to make sure that we've got that one understood. The second one was the historical price for Bitcoin. I believe that was sent to you, although I couldn't remember this morning if I'd actually seen it or not.
I didn't get that.
I didn't receive something that. Came through somewhere in a communication in terms of comparison of Ether, which is a new one.
So let me
communications.
And if you're not sure, then I'm not sure. So let me. That's one reason I wanted to raise it. I want to check over lunch hour and make sure that we've got that one.
I didn't receive it either.
Okay, great. We will do that.
All right. Well, I think that that does this. We will recess for lunch and begin our business session at 1 p.m. Good afternoon, and welcome to the June 26, 2017 business session of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence your cell phones and any other electronic devices you may have. I'd also like to welcome all of our visitors today. We place great value on the public input at all of our meetings. And since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item that is on the agenda, we ask that you come to the microphone to speak, and please state your name and address for the record. And Lisa will hold up the microphone. Thank you, Lisa.
Well done.
Very good job. I'd also like to go back and restate something I said this morning. Today we have a quorum of four commissioners being present. Commissioner Boltz will join us here in a moment. Commissioner Smith has been excused. All of the customary staff members are here today, including the General Manager, Steve Wright, General Counsel, Eric Walquist, and sitting in as Clerk of the Board, Teresa Boucher, and Lisa Sanders, who I forgot to mention this morning, and I apologize. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us.
What are your wishes?
It has been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the motion is carried.
Need a vote.
Nope, we need a vote. Sorry.
All
thank
those
you, Eric.
Aye.
Please say aye.
My apologies.
No problem. We're just voting on the consent agenda.
Yes.
So we got an aye, another aye, and Ann?
Aye.
The ayes have it. We're now down to the regular agenda. Steve would like to have you take over the reading of the resolutions.
We're going to start first. We have I want to ask Debbie Gallagher to come up if she could. And have a seat. She has something she wanted to go over, but before she does that, I'd just like to congratulate Debbie for an amazing success last week with the STEM program that she's run out at Rocky Reach. This is year two. And everything I heard was it was a rousing success. So, Debbie, congratulations on a really well done.
Thank you.
That you came up with, really, and work with FWE.
Well, you know, it was, I always want to be very careful because it was very much a group effort, a group thought. And I was telling Kirk on Friday after the graduation, this is successful because we have support from you. We have support from the board, and we have support from Dan Garrison and Kirk Hudson. We've been approached by other people on how do you do this? How do you pull this STEM Academy off? And we said, before you go and put a lot of work into this, you need to go to the top first. You need to go to, if it's your general manager, it's your senior managers, you need to get their support first, because if you have that, that's going to make this whole program a whole lot easier to do. So, again, thank you very much. The drone section was a huge hit, and Dan Garrison did a fabulous job. Those kids really connected to him, and he let them know when they first came in, hey, you're going to build them, you're doing this, not us, and that was like, yes, because they didn't want help. They wanted to build those drones and take them out and fly them. So the whole week was great. We did have one returning student this year, Colton. And so I asked him, measuring last year to this year, how would you grade us? And so I had to kind of prod him along. So would it be an A, B, C for last year? Well, B or C. Compared to this year, he said yes. This year, he said an A. So, you know, gets a little better each year. But thank you very much.
Well done. You're welcome. Thank you.
So I'm here on another topic. And I want to give you a little information about this. So 11 years ago, a gentleman approached PUD Commissioner Gary Montag, and he asked about opportunities to volunteer for his local PUD. A long story short, the Visitor Center welcomed their first volunteer, and in that process and over the years, we've all come to know, love, and appreciate Jack Pucell. I was able to get Jack here today with a little trickery by telling him that the Visitor Center was in and the staff was invited to the board to present to you guys because you're so, you know, excited about everything that we do. And he fell for that. So Jack came in, and his wife Nadine is here with him. Although I may not have given Jack all the information about why we're here today, the part about informing the board about what's going on at the Visitor Center is very true. Jack has been a faithful volunteer at Rocky Reach Visitor Center for the past 11 years. He's helped in many capacities, working at the front desk, greeting guests, as well as leading tours. Jack does a great job for us at the Visitor Center, and particularly he enjoys leading groups through the Museum of the Columbia. Jack and his wife Nadine participated in our living history play that we had about Wenatchee Valley's past, people of our past, connecting people with Wenatchee's history in a very unique and interactive format. I thought it was also nice, as I was going through all of these past 11 years with Jack, that I had forgotten, and I was reminded again today, that Jack was named Visitor Center Volunteer of the Year by the Association of Visitor Information Centers of Washington State back in 2009. Hmm. So with that said, I'd like to present Jack with a volunteer service recognition. So Jack, could you come up front, please? I also want to just share with you very quickly that, go ahead, have a seat, Jack. It was a couple months ago at the Cashmere Chamber Banquet. Steve was there, and Steve helped present to Jack, along with Bob Bauer, a plaque from Chelan County PUD recognizing Jack for his years of service. But I really felt it was really important that you as a board should know what this man has done for the district and for our community. Jack, during the Cashmere Chamber Banquet, had been named Co-Citizen of the Year for the city of Cashmere along with Tom Green. Jack has spent countless hours and years helping many volunteers and Tom Green putting together the 911 memorial at Riverside Center. If you haven't seen it in Cashmere, it's a beautiful thing to see. Jack, besides volunteering at the Visitor Center and his countless number of hours working on the 911 monument, he's also a veteran of the United States Navy. He drives his Jeep in the parades. He does countless hours of volunteer work for the veterans. So he's an amazing man. So, Jack, in grateful recognition for your 11 years of extraordinary service and dedication to Chelan County PUD and the Rocky Reach Dam Visitor Center, thank you for faithfully volunteering your time to lead, serve, and educate the children of the Wenatchee Valley and beyond. Thank you for sharing insights, amazing facts, and curious trivia about the dam, our community, our culture, and our history. Some of those things that you've done, Jack, are People of Our Past, River of Power, taught and inspired over 1,400 students a year, taught over 15,400 students over the course of 11 years, led tours for elementary schools, middle schools, junior high and high school students, special education and adult learning group tours. He's taken the message of hydropower on the road as far away as Nebraska to his grandchildren's schoolrooms. We load him up with stuff, he goes and he talks about clean, renewable hydro. So for never losing your love for community, your desire to make a difference, your passion to impact the lives of our Valley's children, and your belief in our Valley's future, thank you.
applause so much. I walked into my doctor's office this morning with a bad foot, and the first gal that met me, she says, I know you. You took my fourth grade class around through the Rocky Reach this year and that. So thank you all so very, very much.
He also got a letter was delivered to us right before I came out here today from the ESD for his work with the River of Power program. So this is also a letter from the ESD for his countless hours of volunteer work. So thank you, Jack.
And Jack, before you sit down, I just want you to know, 10 years ago when I was first elected as a commissioner, I heard from you frequently, and your content always had something of significant value. So you were a great mentor, although you may never have realized that, but thank you very much.
We were fighting for water in the monastery.
Yes, we were.
And we got it, and I thank you every day when I turn on my
stick. He's better memory.
The people that fought against it are so happy right now.
Yeah, but thank you for your tutelage.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's cool.
Okay, let the crowd settle for just a second here. All right, agenda item 9, a resolution ratifying and confirming declaration of an emergency and authorizing the general manager to take all steps reasonable and necessary for repairs to the Rock Island Spillway gantry hoist motors. Brett Bickford will tell us about this.
Good afternoon, Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management. At Rock Island, we have 31 spillway bays. 11 of those have automated and fixed hoists that are controlled by operators from the control room. On the other 20 bays, we utilize 2 gantry cranes. Operations has it set up so each one of those cranes is used to operate about 10 of the gates in the event of an emergency. In early June, operations folks identified that one of the cranes wasn't operating properly. Through our technicians and wiremans looking into that crane, we identified that 2 of the hoist motors were on the brink of failure. It was really good that we found that, because if they had failed in operation, it's likely a gate would have been partially up or partially down, and we would have been stuck and had quite difficulty trying to deal with that situation. We're recommending that this be declared an emergency because the spillway operations is so vital to Rock Island, and both of these cranes are needed to help meet our obligations to quickly to respond to an emergency. We've looked around and found some entities that could do this work, and so we got proposals from them. We found one. We negotiated a contract. These motors are with that entity now. They've disassembled them. We've identified the issues, and repairs are underway.
And just for sake of clarity for the record, actually, General Manager declared the emergency, so this resolution ratifies and confirms that declaration.
And Brett, if you would just for a second describe the probability of the event and the consequence of the event that we've been protecting against for declaring the emergency.
Yeah, fortunately, the probability is low of such an emergency. However, this is one of the years we've seen the highest flows that we've seen on record in some months, particularly April. And so we want to, you know, err on the side of conservatism, make sure that we can get this piece of equipment back in service as soon as possible. The probability is low. The consequence is very high. If we can't react in time, unfortunately, Rock Island will be subject to overtopping, cause damage to the equipment and the environment, and also be quite dangerous with our crews out there just trying to operate with one crane. And so it puts them in harm's way when they don't have all the resources they need to be able to respond.
Great. I'm sure there's any questions?
Right. Just a comment. I don't know if this is on. I think that's great that we can be nimble and responsive and not bogged down in bureaucratic red tape, that this can happen for you, and you know, it's in everybody's best interest.
Yep.
I have to jump in and say that Commissioner McKenna and myself were given a tour of Rock Island not long ago, and we heard about some of the issues with this particular crane, and it really brings it to life for a commissioner who's sitting here to actually go and view the property and to have firsthand visual contact, so that when Brett, you're here and you're talking about this, I actually in my mind's eye now see what it is the problem is or could be, And so it sure helps us to embrace these kind of situations when it is an emergency and we have to move forward, understanding the consequences, which would be severe. So thank you for coming today. Thank you for expressing
this. You're welcome.
Commissioners, I would propose items 10 and 12 were already moved to the consent agenda. I would propose jumping over item 11 because we discussed it this morning and just moving to item 13 unless there's an objection.
No objection.
Then item 13, a resolution authorizing the general manager to enter into a services agreement, SA number 16-175 with Cache Valley Electric Company of Tigard, Oregon, for CCTV camera system replacement and support. Rich Hyatt, Felicity Saberhagen will be presenting.
Good afternoon. We're here to request approval for you to enter into the resolution with Cache Valley Electric Company. The district began planning for this project in 2015. It's been budgeted each of the years for the different phases. And our existing system is 2002, so from a technology perspective, we've gotten 15 years of life out of it, which has been really good. It's an analog system that's no longer supported by the manufacturer Pelco, so we're looking at doing that the next phase, which is to move it to a digital IP-based system.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Rich Hyatt, Director of Security. I wanted to talk to the scope of the project. It's replacement of all analog cameras with new digital IP-based cameras at new and existing district installations. We currently have 130 cameras, and we plan on increasing that number to 165. Replacement of the existing analog cameras, switching equipment, and video recording equipment with new video management server and integral video storage. Basically increases our storage capacity four times with up to 30 days of video on demand. Replacement of all district analog video monitoring workstations with new digital workstations and monitors. There's currently 40 stations around the district, 4 in use by security and 36 in use by the operation. Installation and migration to a new video management program, Genetech, to operate the new cameras on the digital network. Video analytics, motion-activated cameras to produce event-driven surveillance enhances our physical security tenfold. And then a 5-year service agreement for technical support for the video management program. On April 14th of this year, we received 4 responses from the prospective firms. The evaluation team met and we reviewed the RFPs, and we determined that Cache Valley Electric was the most qualified, scoring number 1 in 4 of the 5 categories for industry experience, hardware specifications, software specifications, training and support. They came in 2nd lowest bidder, but the timeline to complete the project was significantly different from the lowest bidder, and we opted to recommend them. Is there any questions?
Commissioner?
I'll just repeat the question I asked of Rich earlier. One of the things... This puts us in a great position by doing this to give us the capability in the future to provide not only the surveillance of a substation, but actually have someone say, hey, what are you doing there? The police are on their way. You better quit breaking the sprinkler heads off or whatever.
Yeah.
I witnessed that the other day.
We'd be worrying a little bit more about the sprinkler heads. But let me clarify. The video management system, we have our own physical security network that is our own fiber line. And we would be able to put IP addressable intercoms or PA systems at any facility we chose to. It would just require a switch and 2 ports. And as we set the table with this new technology, it gives us all those capabilities for when we need to ramp up and increase our security posture.
Commissioners, any other questions?
Nope.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Items 14, 15, and 16 are all ones that we covered at the last meeting, but we do want to refresh your view of that. So Item 14 is a resolution selecting and authorizing implementation of the 2017 and 2018 public power benefit program options and related budget item. So this is important relative to both commitments for 2017 and 2018 under public power benefit.
I'm Michael Enderman, Management Analyst in District Services. It's going to be a short presentation. Just a recap of June 5th, 3 weeks ago, then a summary of the resolution for 2017, and then question and next steps. So a recap of what we did 3 weeks ago. Came to the board looking for guidance and help us fill in the blanks, as this isn't just for public power benefits, but also has an impact on the budget as well. A reminder of 2017, any projects that we fund will reduce the unassigned amounts. And the same thing for 2018. So back today to answer any questions that you've had over the last few weeks and seek approval for a resolution. The resolution is only 700 words long, so if a picture is worth 1,000 words, this is only worth 700. But three bullet points to really drive home what the resolution is about. Setting aside $4 million in funding for public power benefits in 2018. And then with respect to 2017, the first bar you see, assigning $1.25 million. $1 million of that would be to the Rocky Reach Visitor Center. $250,000 would be for the Hydro Research Institute. Then the second bar, 2018, would be about $2.8 million assigning funds in total. The majority of that is fiber. Another $250,000 for the Hydro Research Institute. And about $35,000 for the Parks Day Use Pass. So I assure you that the Parks Day Use Pass is in there. It's just less than 1%, so you're going to have to squint to see it. Glasses on or off, it's going to be really tough to see.
I see it.
So at this stage, do you have any questions? And if you like, I can go back to a previous slide if you want to see the layout.
Very clear.
Good. I guess there's no questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Did a good job.
Okay, the next two items Kathy Melton will speak to. Item 15, a resolution amending the electric line extension policy, the water and wastewater line extension policy, and the telecom service installation policy portions of the district's utility service policies. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Kathy Melton, Customer Service Program Analyst. And as Steve said, these are follow-up items that we discussed on the June 5th meeting. The first resolution that I'm looking at is for modifications to the electric water, wastewater, and also the telecom service installation policies. Essentially, what this is doing is just adding some clarity for customers to let them know that there will be perhaps some extra steps that they will need to take to mitigate any risks for line extensions located in limited access areas or severe terrain and things like that. And the next resolution that we have is making some alterations to sections within the utility service regulations. And that would be sections 27. And that's just adding in some additional language where we would need to install a load monitor capable meter to identify load profiles and also to properly administer rate 35 that was passed last summer. Section 40, that's just differentiating the ability for us to terminate service when needed for safety concerns. It's an entirely separate process from disconnection for non-payment. So this would be something that would need to mitigate safety. And the final section in that is going to be section 41, that's changes in load. And that's identifying that we're going to be reducing the change in load amount from 300 kW to 150, requiring a new service application, allowing opportunity for us to have pause to evaluate what impacts that change in load may have on our system. And that's it.
Okay.
Any questions?
Yep. Any questions, Commissioner? No. Kathy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Whipping right through everything right here.
And actually, I think we're done with resolutions at this point. Okay. We have one motion to get to next.
Okay. So we'll vote on resolutions. Commissioners, do I hear a motion to approve resolutions 9, 11, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17? I think that's all of them.
16. We'll have 17 is a motion.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept resolutions 9 through 16 as presented.
Other than
10 and 12 removed consent.
So yeah, they were on the consent. Yeah. Yep. Thank you.
Second.
Second. So it's been moved and seconded to approve the resolutions 9, 11, 13, 14, 15, 16. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, say no. The ayes have it. Motion is carried.
Thank you. Item 17 is the insurance policy renewal for 2017 and 18. You did hear about this last time, but Ron Gibbs has got an update for you.
Ron Gibbs, insurance and claims manager. So I'm just here to seek approval of the district's insurance program renewal, again, in follow-up to the June 6th presentation. And the quoted premiums since that time we've been negotiating just have changed very slightly. We negotiated the liability insurance down another $20,000. And as you might recall, we're increasing the liability limits. The recommendation is to increase it from $100 million up to $125 million. And so within that negotiation, we would be paying an additional 4.8% for the liability insurance, increasing the premiums by $25 million, or I'm sorry, insurance, increasing the limits $25 million. So overall, you can see that our program premiums have will have dropped 5.5% from $2.2 million down to just over $2.1 million. And again, with that increase in liability limit. So we typically recommend to complete the annual negotiation process with a not to exceed amount in the motion. And this year, we put in just a little bit higher, less than $5,000 over and above the quotes. And we do that just because with so many different insurance companies quoting, every now and then we'll get somebody that's miscalculated something and has to come back, or they might even offer an option for us. We just have a very slight amount above of what we reported here. So, and that's really about it. Are there any questions about what we're doing?
That looks really good.
I like the 5.5 reduction.
Yeah, like that. With an increase in rates.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful.
So really at this point, I just would ask that you consider the motion.
And the motion's in your agenda, Commissioner.
So, Commissioners, we have a, do you want me to read it?
Chairman. I move, Mr. Chairman, that we authorize expenditures by the district not to exceed $2,120,000 plus surplus line taxes and fees for the purchase of district insurance for July 1, 2017-2018 policies upon terms and conditions approved by the general manager.
Second.
So it's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? No. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those against say no. The ayes have it. Motion carried.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
My automobile insurance just went up. Would you take a look at it for me?
Okay. We have some updates for you from manager items. Janet is here. Great, Janet Jaspers, if you'd like to come up and talk a little bit about Lake Chelan.
Good afternoon. My name is Janet Jaspers, Energy Planning and Trading Manager. And I'm just here to give an update on Lake Chelan, so no action required of you today. This is going to be a real quick update. Here is the annual graph of Lake Chelan. And so the green line is the actual elevation of 2016-2017. And the blue shaded area is kind of the normal operating range that we have come up with. The yellow diamonds are the target elevations, and so we have been filling the lake quite nicely. Today it's 1098.8, and July 1st we have a target of 1098, so we're already at about 0.8 feet above that July 1st target. So coming in kind of nicely right there. Before I came in here, I talked to Becky Keating, and she's the one who has been operating the lake this year and coming up with the plans. Every year, people say, oh, it's going to be an easy year this year. It's, you know, it's cake. And so this year, it's especially difficult. And so on April 1st, we like to go do our kind of forecast, come up with our snow survey, go measure the snow, and do our, quote, final forecast. On April 1st, the Northwest River Forecast Center also does their forecast. They had 98% of normal on that day. We do like to do our own forecast. We're about 106% of normal on April 1st. Since then, we got a whole lot of precip in April and kind of a cool May. And so, as you can see, these forecasts just kept increasing over time. And then we see this really step increase in late May. And there wasn't any precip or big snow events up there in the mountains, but the Northwest River Forecast Center just decided to bump it up. And so I just kind of wanted to translate what that means in feet of water at the lake. And so from April 1st at 98% of normal to today, which is 145% of normal runoff. So that's 14 feet of water in the lake. That difference in volume between those forecasts is 14 feet of volume. Or if you want to think about it in spill, typically our max spill we like to ever do is 6,000 CFS spill. And that's 38 days of spill at 6,000 CFS. So even if you say, oh, we were thinking 106% compared to their 145%, that's still 12 feet difference to kind of plan for 12 feet like difference. So we have been really studying this closely. So I'd like to thank Becky Keating, who has done the majority work. Ryan Collier also has been her underling for the last several weeks. Anyway, so it's looking really nice. We're spilling right at 4,000 CFS today. That will come down as inflows start to subside, but we've had some real hot weather, and inflows really have peaked up the last couple of days. Any questions?
Were we spilling at 4,000 CFS over the weekend? Or yes. A little more?
Yes. And so over the last 35 days, we've averaged 5,000 CFS. We've had 4,000 over the weekend. Probably hang there for a couple of days till we inflows really drop off after this couple of days of real high temps. And the max we've spilled this whole spring was 7,400.
That's what was my next question. Yeah. So we didn't ever... was it last year or the year before we spilled it? Was it last year, 9,000?
Yes.
A couple times?
Yep, we're at 9,000.
So I have a question. I should know this, but I drove out and looked in the gorge this weekend. Mm-hmm. And it is the most magnificent color, turquoise color.
Yeah.
You just don't see that color anywhere else in nature. It's just phenomenal. What causes that? Is that the silt and the nitrogen and the?
Come on, Janet.
I'm from Montana. I always say it's God's country, but probably here too. I really don't know.
You've seen it though. It's just beautiful.
I think, typically in the rivers, you get a lot of silt and runoff, and I think in that gorge, it's just so rocky, it doesn't pick up near the amount of silt or mud, and so it just looks really pretty blue.
Yeah,
it is.
Really is pretty.
It's unusual color. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet.
145%. Wow.
Everyone asks me what I think, and I'm going to do 126.
You're going to settle on that, huh?
And if you want to bet,
call me. guys are amazing, though. Honestly, I don't know how you manage the lake like you do. Terrific.
Yeah. I don't get email on the lake level this year, last year.
Oh, you don't get?
No, I mean, people aren't concerned about it. Yeah, no.
Oh, no,
the management, yeah.
It's been up early the last 2 years.
It's been really, really good.
2 years.
Yeah. So thank you.
Okay, we'd like to invite Jeff Smith up.
Jeff Smith, Managing Director, District Services. It's our pleasure to announce that our Fleet Department has been recognized as a top performer by the National Association of Fleet Administrators. Have a seat, gentlemen. And Craig Weddle, the Supply Chain and Fleet Manager, will introduce the team and describe the significance of this recognition. Craig?
Yeah, thank you. So this is fun. Usually the only time we get to talk about fleet is when something's broken down and we're not getting it fixed quick enough. So this is a unique opportunity, and I'm really happy to be here. So why don't you guys introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Gordon Zimmerman. I've been with Fleet for 20 years now. So I'm the day foreman.
Hi, Chris Skoglund. I'm the management analyst for Fleet, and I've been there for a full 3 years and 1 month as of tomorrow. So.
They've all got me beat. I'm Lance Knutson, the new Fleet supervisor. I've been here just over a year.
So Gordon is the day shift foreman, so he manages the shop on the day shift and schedules the work and answers phones and deals with all the customers coming in. So he's a really important guy for this group. Chris is our management analyst. He handles a lot of the computer technology stuff, a lot of our metrics and reporting and those type of things. And Lance is a supervisor, been with us about 14 months, as he said, and he's doing a great job. And if I could just take like 1 minute and tell you a little bit about our fleet, since we don't get up here very often with this group. We have about 850 mobile assets in our fleet that these guys take care of. About 320 vehicles, all kinds of specialty equipment, cranes, backhoes, forklifts, boats, snowcats. I mean, an extremely diverse fleet. So our guys are really the best in the business. They have to know how to take care of all of that variety of equipment. This award is from the National Association of Fleet Administrators, NAFA. It's a organization of municipal fleets covering all of North America. Actually, they say the Americas, but mostly North America and largely United States. There's about 7,000 members in NAFA and about 38,000 municipal fleets in the Americas. So it's a very large, there's a lot of us out there. Every year they have a application process where we send in information, and last winter I didn't even know Lance was doing this, filled out an application and sent it in to him on our behalf, kept it a secret until this spring. He was at a national conference in, I believe it was Orlando, where they announced their top 100. So they have a committee of industry experts that review all the materials that are sent in by all the applicants, and they select a top 100 fleet every year. And it was announced down there this spring that we were selected on our first application as the number 58 fleet in North America out of all those thousands of municipal fleets. So something that we're really proud of. We're a work in progress in the fleet department. We've got a lot of work to do, and we certainly can still get better at what we do, and we're trying to do that. But that was a pretty neat honor to get for the group. They work really hard. And it was pretty cool. So some of the stuff that they look at in the application process is innovation and use of technology, stewardship of resources, including natural resources, cost effectiveness, employee development programs, just kind of those types of things, among others. A couple of unique things that we've done in the last year here that I think probably helped with this award is we last year worked on with the management folks from the operating units to establish a formal customer service agreement, a formal written customer service agreement between Fleet and the operating units that we support in the district, where we wrote down roles and clarified and talked about roles and responsibilities and expectations of Fleet and the customers to help us do the job we do, some metrics and reporting and things that we agreed to and then we follow up on. And one of the new programs we did out of that was we established, at the request of the operating units, a program of tracking the availability of critical assets. So each of the operating units told us what assets in the fleet of theirs that are critical to their operations that they just absolutely have to have available to them during their working hours. And then we implemented a tracking and reporting process to track the availability of those assets during the working hours of the week of 6 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day. And we tracked that. And we had set a goal of 95% availability. That is about 100 assets that were considered critical that we identified across the district. And so far, just about 6 months into that process, we're averaging about a 99% availability. And I don't know what the national average is, according to NAFA, but they told us that was far better than the average. Yeah. So we're pretty proud of that, and we've set the bar high, and we're going to keep trying to improve on that. So we just thank you for the opportunity to get these guys in front of you. It doesn't happen very often, and it's pretty cool. So thank you.
Congratulations. Yeah. Congratulations. Nice. Congratulations.
Really good.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Craig.
Bring them back anytime. Yeah.
I want to know what they drink in the water down there. They all have a full head of hair. I wonder what our problem is.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
It couldn't be related to age, probably. Huh?
Next up, we want to give you a report on the Spring Chinook Run. So, Lean Underwood's going to do that for us.
Gordon.
Good afternoon. I'm Aline Underwood, manager of the Fish and Wildlife Department. I wanted to give you an update. A couple months ago, I sent out an email. There was some news that the Spring Chinook Run at Bonneville was looking to be very low. So the technical advisory group, which is a coalition of co-managers, decided that the run size at Bonneville was going to be about 160,000 Spring Chinook. And about a month and a half ago, they downcasted it in half to 83,000 Spring Chinook. And then we started seeing some fish trickle over Bonneville, and then they increased it to 110,000. So the good news is that as of a few days ago, we have about 105,000 Spring Chinook over Bonneville, so close to their third estimate. Unfortunately, it's still only about 60% of the 10-year average for what we normally see over Bonneville. Closer to our neck of the woods at Rock Island, we're at about 8,600 fish, which is around 45% of the 10-year average. It is one of the lower years that we've seen in the past 10 years. We're still not done getting Spring Chinook at Rock Island because the run was very much delayed. The running hypothesis are that the run was delayed based on the huge flows we were having throughout the whole river and water temperatures were just really cold. So the cues for those fish to start migrating just weren't there. A report has also come out that has corrected a previous report in May that suggests that the pinniped predation, because the Spring Chinook were kind of milling about in the estuary longer than normal, the pinniped predation probably was a lot larger this year than we've experienced in the past. They're estimating anywhere between maybe 5,000, 10,000 fish, which of a run of 110,000 isn't extraordinary. However, there is also a running hypothesis that the upper river Spring Chinook tend to be the earliest that migrate from the ocean up the river. And so as the pinnipeds move in, it's actually potentially more of the upriver fish that are actually getting predated upon by the pinnipeds. So that work is still ongoing. There's a final report that's probably going to come out in a month or two. This is the third year that the U.S. Corps of Engineers has studied this specifically. And so we're continuing to track what that does for us up here. But really, we're going to get our broodstock for our hatchery programs. The state just opened a fishery in the Icicle for excess broodstock needs for the hatchery fish up there on the Icicle River. So not a glorious year, but not anything sort of doom and gloom that folks were predicting a couple months ago.
Helene's a scientist. I just Googled pinniped.
Yeah.
Pinnipeds, seals, sea lions, and walruses. The word pinniped means fin or flipper-footed and refers to the marine mammals that have front and rear flippers.
That's correct.
Ped. I knew what ped was, but anyway.
Yeah. So sea lions, that kind of thing. It's just they do track them based on as a seal or a sea lion, but it's easier just to say pinniped because they all eat salmon.
Good. Commissioners, any more questions?
No. I just wanted to compliment Eileen for some great parenting the other day. My wife and I were strolling past the volleyball courts, and, of course, we had a letter that accused children of being rude and disruptive, and there was a great mom reminding her children that the sand belonged in the volleyball court. And I was seeing this from a distance and then got close enough to realize who it was, but it was still great parenting, and thank you.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Good report.
Okay, next up, I want to invite the recently arrived Holly Krebs. Checking back to see if she got off the plane and made it here. I want to talk about an update to our marketing program. You may recall that in 2014, the board gave us authority to look at long-term transactions, and we have a success to describe there.
So, yeah, we signed our first long-term deal under that resolution on Friday, so yay. And it's with Avista, who's been a great counterparty for us. It's a 5% of Rocky Reach and Rock Island output transaction, so it's a slice of system. That's about 52 average megawatts of energy, about 92 megawatts of capacity. 10-year deal, 2021 to 2030. Revenue's a little over $14 million a year, year one, and then it escalates at 4% a year after that. The other thing it does for us is it's risk mitigation for us. So it mitigates forward price exposure for us, stream flow risk and operational issues when we sell the slice products. So we're happy to get one done and we're working on more.
That's good. You said that was 20 years, right?
10 years.
10 years, sir.
Sorry. 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm like,
thank you.
2021 is the start date.
Thank you.
Questions? Have you met Steve McKenna? Holly Krebs?
Hi.
I think maybe at the last one when I was just sitting in the row. But
what's your title again, Holly?
Power Marketing Manager.
Yeah, yeah. But she's based in Portland,
Vancouver side, but yeah, Washington side.
Mm. So big success.
That's great.
Been working on this for a long time. Holly's really and Brian Bradshaw really done great job of working through to get us to this point.
Yeah, it's been a big group effort, so a lot of people, including our legal team, have put in a lot.
Well, he's a great taskmaster.
Try.
But what a commissioner likes about Holly is she can actually take fairly complex things, break them down into my level of understanding, and actually walk away with some information that is useful. So thank you.
Good. Well, you're welcome.
Holly, it's good news. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great work.
Thanks, all.
I believe that is it for our manager items.
Okay. Well, we talked about commissioner items this morning, but did we conclude any other additional commissioner items?
I don't have any.
Nope. Okay. How about follow-up on delegation?
So we did go back and check that one, and it turned out that we had done the work. Just hadn't pushed the send button on the one.
Okay.
So that was sent during the lunch hour. So you now have the historical Bitcoin prices.
Perfect. Thank you. Delegation of action items.
So we have two. So I wanted us to review the field work order change order procedures as part of the delegation. Just give some more thought to that about, I think what I really heard was some sideboards around that so that we don't end up with big things that are going on that the board wouldn't know about or we had significant changes. And help me with this one, Lisa.
Yeah. So I unfortunately I have to say that I think all of them are mine, which is disappointing. but they all do, at least the ones I have, relate to the delegation resolution. So the field recorder change order sideboards, the sole source continued discussion, and the one page pictorial representation of it. So I have those.
Great. Thank you. Well, at looking around, do we have any public, any additional public comment? See anyone from the public here? So I guess we're going to go into executive session. Is that right?
Yes, Commissioner, and I would say that I don't believe, well, yes, for the reasons stated, if you'd read that. Thank you.
Read this from this document. We have a need for an executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by RCW 42.30.110(i), and to review the performance of a public employee as authorized by RCW 42.30.110(1)(b), and to consider the selection of a site or the acquisition of real estate by lease or purchase when public knowledge regarding such consideration would cause a likelihood of increased price as authorized by RCW 42.30.110(1)(b). So do we need a short break before executive session?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll take five.
Is that five? Oh, yeah, five. Five.
Take 5 minutes. So yeah. We'll start back at 2 okay. o'clock.
We'll do it for 60 minutes, although I really think we'll be less.
Okay, for 60 minutes. Great. We are coming out of executive session. It is June 26, 2017. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we will stand adjourned.